Okay, we're back. This is Rick Davis.
This is Aaron Edwards.
And you're listening to The Things That Matter Most, the show where we bring you evidence to help you decide what you think is true and what is not about the most important questions of life. And we are partway through a very interesting interview with Gary Habermas and Keith Augustine, and the subject today is...
Near-death experiences.
Near-death experience.
And Keith, I want to start with you. Let me ask you this. I heard you say a while ago in your opening statement that you believe that all near-death experiences are hallucinatory. So from a scientific point of view, would you say, so you don't believe that one is able to experience any consciousness outside of their own brain activity?
Yeah, I would say that that's what the current evidence seems to point towards.
Okay, so there's basically nothing that takes place, you don't believe, outside of our own brain waves or, you know, so in anything that someone might see whenever they're, let's say, laying in a bed or wherever they might have, wherever this near-death experience might have taken place, there's nothing that they could see that's outside of themselves.
Yeah, that would be pretty much my position.
Okay. Gary, I have a question for you. Are there any evidences that make you disbelieve near-death experiences? Anything that Keith has said or other skeptics have claimed that you don't really have a satisfying answer to?
No. Like I said, I think Keith's response is fairly typical. I do credit him for something. He responds to the evidential cases, and most critics do not. They respond to most of the responses out there are to the life review, going down the tunnel, and this doesn't prove anything. I agree, it proves nothing. I say that regularly. I think he's doing well to respond to the evidential cases, but I would admit the people misperceive. I would admit there are cultural differences. I would admit there are different stages. My point is, like his seems to be in his essay, we need to respond to the evidential cases. And if your thesis is hallucination, go for it. Tell me how you can get some of these with hallucination.
Keith, what would you say in response to Gary about the so-called evidential cases?
Well, sure. The first thing is that I think near-death experiences are like more generally like religious experiences. You know, if you accept that some religious experiences are real and some are not, you have this issue of, well, how do you sort the real from the illusory ones? And obviously, anyone of any religious persuasion is going to believe that there are illusory religious experiences because they're not going to accept that an experience that caused someone to become a Muslim was going to be, if they're not Muslim, a veridical religious experience. And I think you have the same problem with near-death experiences. But basically, you have to sort between, if you take the position that some near-death experiences are really experiences of an afterlife, which ones are real and which ones are not. So I just want to say that I don't think that it's obvious that near-death experiences are hallucinations. This is something that we've sort of discovered, is what I would say. But the hallucinatory features I've discovered, I don't anticipate that they would be found in every single near-death experience. In fact, you only find them occasionally. The point would be that they show that at least some near-death experiences are questionable. And this gives us grounds for extrapolating that, well, maybe not all near-death experiences, you know, they might not be real either. So, like, when you have a dream, you can have a very realistic dream that doesn't have any elements that would tell you that that was a dream when you woke up. Wow, was that a dream? But that doesn't mean that the dream was real. And I think what this sort of illustrates is that, you know, occasionally near-death experiences have these features which suggest that they're hallucinations. And that gives us reason to think that other near-death experiences are, you know, at least as suspect on the same grounds.
Okay, go ahead.
Is that enough?
No, if you have something else, you can say it. But I was just going to ask.
I can wait until another question.
Okay, well, I was just going to ask Gary. What you were pretty much saying the same thing, weren't you, or were you not? I mean, as far as the hallucinatory aspect of it, you were saying that maybe some of the experiences are hallucinatory.
Well, some experiences are either in whole or in part present the kind of data Keith is talking about. I think it's interesting when he says we only find occasional cases with clear hallucinatory data. I think that's true. But the false cause philosophical error, the logical clear thinking error that I mentioned earlier, comes when we jump from some cases to all cases. Well, that's actually another error. When you jump from some cases to all cases, or when you argue from general to specific, or jargon. I have a few here that are like this, therefore they're all like this.
Right.
The false cause says we have some hallucinations here, therefore they all may be hallucinations. And I'm saying, hey, you could have a whole mixed bag here. I mean, for example, in a report of a car accident, in a very important study of evidence, it's irrelevant. I mean, it doesn't discuss religion at all. But in a discussion of evidence, they'll often say that the best cases are the ones that have contrast but agree on the central things. Just because people don't quite remember whether the car that did the damage was red or purple doesn't mean there was no accident. And so I would admit features, and that's unquestionable when you look at it.
Right.
The main problem is not just the part of the experience that is not hallucinatory or the experiences for which we don't have those kind of handles, and Keith seems to think there are many like that if what he says is, it's only occasional hallucinatory data cases. What I'm interested in are some highly, highly evidential cases, not just when people report data. His example of you can report data from a dream, certainly you can. But I'm talking about where you clearly report data that can be measured a distance away.
Okay, Gary, how about an example of that? You're talking about highly evidential cases. Give us an example in maybe a minute.
Okay, there's an example. I've got a lot of these things to pick from, but let me say there's a case that's been written up in two different medical journals of a little girl who was without heartbeat and without brainwave activities for 19 minutes minimum. She reported being up above her body and being able to see into her home a distance away and to be able to report precisely what her mother, father, brother, and sister were doing at that moment. She named what her mom was making for dinner, for example.
Hmm.
Now, she came to a relatively brief time after that and told her experience. This isn't a five-year later interview. This was discovered very quickly, and she spontaneously recovered from a flat brain, flat heart, and started telling the story. It took the doctors 1 hour to copy down details, and they were confirmed because they could ask the mother, what did you make for dinner two nights ago?
Right. Well, I guess my first comment there is I wonder what mom was doing making dinner when her daughter was dying.
I'm kidding. They didn't know her daughter was in trouble.
A little bit of levity there in a very serious topic. And Keith, what's your response to that?
Well, I don't know the details of that specific case.
Let's say that Gary characterizes that correctly. First of all, is it possible that he's characterizing that correctly, or does that sound so outlandish to you that he couldn't possibly be? And then if you will concede that, what if he is characterizing it correctly, what would you say to it?
Well, I would say at least 2 points I want to make at the forefront. One is that claims that people have experiences while their brain's completely inactive aren't completely correct. EEGs may be flat, but part of the reason for that is because they're not measuring the core brain activity and like the center of the brain. They just read the cerebral cortex activity.
Okay.
And if your brain was completely flat, it would be irrecoverable. You wouldn't be able to be resuscitated except in cases in which you are brought to that state, like in standstill when they lower your body temperature.
Mm-hmm.
The brain death is irreversible if it's truly brain death. That's mm-hmm. part of the reason that these are called near-death experiences and not death experiences. Second of all, regarding the veridical nature case, the girl seeing something that she couldn't have possibly known about. Well, a part of the problem with that is how accurate is the report. But two, so the report could have been embellished over time. We don't know the details. But also along those lines, though.
Do you find, Keith, that most of these cases, when you look into them, it ends up that the reporting was embellished over time?
Well, it depends. See, a lot of them have different. He's saying that in this particular case, there wasn't really any time for embellishment.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth is that we don't know which report is he looking at. Is he looking at the report that was given right when she was resuscitated? Was someone in the room recording what she said, or was this something that came second or third hand from a researcher who wrote a book, 3 or 4 years later?
Right. Well, I, for that specific instance, I believe he was talking about there it being in a couple of medical journals. But, I mean, Keith, have you ever, I mean, obviously you're pretty well read on near-death experiences, and, you know, that's why you're on here. But, I mean, have you run into any situations that you weren't able to explain away at all because of the overwhelming evidence that there's no way that that could have happened other than they saw it firsthand?
Well, the problem is, of course, that like with cases like this, with any sort of case where there's a paranormal claim, is that there are a multitude of claims like that. And what you have to do is look at each particular case. So what I've done is looked at what the near-death researchers say are the most compelling cases. And in those cases, I found that they're not nearly as compelling as near-death researchers say they are. So one example that's a famous example is Maria and her shoe. There was this woman who was called Maria. No one knows her real name or, you know, other than her first name.
Right.
And supposedly she saw this shoe she couldn't have possibly seen. From her hospital room when she left, she said she left her body. And no one can find this woman, so it's very difficult to corroborate her story. Just the researcher reported it secondhand. But the researcher who reported it said all kinds of things, like you couldn't see the shoe from the ledge and from inside the rooms and different things like that. And these investigators at the Skeptical Inquirer magazine actually went to the hospital and found that even though, like, a construction area was placed in front of where they were, limiting their access even more than when the incident supposedly happened, they could clearly see where they had put a shoe on the ledge from outside the building, and that when they left it there, people actually took it down, even though they didn't tell anyone that they had put the shoe there to, you know, do their test.
Right.
They came back a week later, it was down, so someone else had noticed it and removed it. So that's an example where the claims made at the time were, you know, by the researcher at least, were embellished in a sense.
Hmm. Well, I know that's a reality in science, you know, that they do discover people that are, you know, the scientists aren't, this is arguably parascience or something, but even in the hard sciences, it's arguable that scientists aren't objective and really want to prove their thesis. So that's similar to what you're saying, right, Keith?
Yeah, I think there is a element of, and I think this is true with the experiencers themselves, is, you know, I want to show that this was something real and not just something in my mind. So, you know, over time they're going to have details, not even necessarily intentionally, but over time as they retell the stories, they're going to, you know, add details that tend to
right.
bolster the
right.
veridical
yeah.
nature.
I
experience.
Do that.
Yeah.
Sometimes, like, you know, try to make sure that the other person believes you
right.
in this or that. Yeah. I mean, not with regard to near-death experiences, but just sort of in life.
Yeah, just in life.
Yeah.
And, you know,
just imagine how much more compelling it would be in that situation, though.
Sure.
Well, you know, it's pretty compelling, but, excuse me, Gary, I was just going to ask you for your response on that, but
yeah.
also I was going to ask if, you know, one of the compelling arguments for Keith's case is what he was talking about with the cultural expectations and,
right.
And it, I mean, have you found any instances where those who are living in other cultures saw something other than what their cultural expectation was?
Yeah, let me respond to those two questions. I'll take the second one first. In the 600-case Indian study written up by two psychologists, Osis and Haraldson, one of the examples of the cultural differences were that most Americans, just over 50%, when they see other people over the, you know, on the other side, quote unquote, they report that a slight majority is women. They see women in this country. But Indian cases, the vast majority are male of people they say they see, deceased relatives and so on. And the researcher said, well, that's because the male society, the society is more male driven in India than it is in the U.S. And I have no problem with that sort of thing. But I still think we have to explain the core of the circumstances. And I would ask Keith or respond to Keith with some of these things. First of all, it is not true. It is just not medically true that there are no such things as reversible EEGs except in standstill-type procedures. As he mentioned, people are regularly resuscitated. I mean, very, very, very often they're resuscitated from flat brainwave situations. I can give you cases if you want, but they're very commonly so. For example, a heart attack case that goes on for a long time is a very common case, and yet that person, you have the scales, you have the machines, you know that there's no EKG, there's no EEG, they're putting the paddles on their chest. It's pretty radical. You don't do that for no reason. But then the person's up and walking around and alive today, and we have the reports of what they experienced. As far as embellishment over the time, the little girl who drowned or nearly drowned, the doctor who reported her near-death experience was A, an agnostic, B, he was one of the two doctors that resuscitated her in the room, and three, C, he was one of the two doctors. She got the same two doctors because she picked them out. She said, thanks for resuscitating me, and that kind of got the ball rolling.
Mm-hmm.
They were the same two that resuscitated her, and they talked to her pretty quickly, but they were in the emergency room. I've had hours of conversation with the main medical doctor, and one thing about embellishment.
Gary, you've personally talked to the doctor that had this experience?
Who resuscitated the girl. In almost all my cases that I've researched, I have discussed this with the researchers in question, most of whom are medical doctors. Yes, I've had hours of conversation with these guys in my research.
Interesting.
But with embellishment, the point I was going to make was embellishment cuts both ways. Keith is not unprejudiced because I'm just making things up about him. I'm just saying anything. Let's just say for the sake of the argument, he's not a religious person. You don't stop from embellishing things because you're not religious. And Christians don't automatically embellish, or Buddhists or Muslims don't automatically embellish because they're Christians or religious. All people, like the joke you guys made, we all embellish things from time to time. And therefore, no matter who you are, you can't assume there's no embellishment. You got to dig through the cases, just like a judge or a journalist or a lawyer does, and you have to get to the core experience. This one with this little girl is a better one. But it's one of many, many highly evidenced cases like that. Like I said, I have dozens right here in front of me on a sheet.
Hey, Gary, I'm going to stop you right there. We've actually gone over into our third segment, so we're going to take a break, and we'll do that right now and come back in a minute. So to our listeners, you're listening to The Things That Matter Most with Rick Davis.
Aaron Edwards.
And we will be back in just a minute.